Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Cindy Baldwin.
And you're listening to the midweek version of Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for those who stab ground cloth.
Oh, we're stabbing this week, huh?
And I'm not sure that the prospects of it getting to an artist level before the end of the week are that great. So we're just going to kind of keep an attitude and an edge this week, I think. Stitch and chat tonight on the Fiber Talk Stitch Hour. Remote chance that we'll have a guest, but haven't heard back from her. So we're just going to plan to stitch and chat, and then we'll work it out from there. So, but join us no matter what, 8 o'clock Eastern time on the YouTube channel. Sunday is Nancy Lukoski of Fancy Work Stitching, Fancy Work Finishing. Nancy, if you're a longtime listener, 3 years ago, I think it was, maybe more, we did a show with her. And her needlepoint finishing is her deal. And one of her biggest clients for a long time is the National Cathedral. So if you see a funeral or an event on TV on the, at the National Cathedral and they kneel on the kneeling pads, communion rail, prayer stand, whatever it is, those pads are all Nancy's work in one way or another. She's either restored them, stitched them, finished them, or all of the above. And amazing story. And she's transitioning now from doing all of that work to teaching people how to do this stuff and do it at the highest level. And she's to the point now where her hands just hurt her so much when she does the work, she just can't do it anymore. So chances to take classes from her and learn about needlepoint finishing. You know, this is basic needlepoint with wool on heavy canvas, but to learn that from one of the best who has done the work for at the very highest end. So she's going to be the Sunday guest, and then if all things work out, she will join us next Wednesday on the Stitch Hour, and she has some videos of her work at the cathedral and some of her other work, and we'll get to see photos and hear the stories. So,
cool.
Yeah.
So I've been in the National Cathedral, but it's been a long time ago. I don't remember noticing the kneelers.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were looking at the stained glass windows and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's probably, I've never been there. I got to believe that's a lot to take in. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful building.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Well, yeah, yeah. So, she's a special one, and the classes she's going to start to offer and so on and so forth will be good ones to learn. So Sunday for that, and hopefully next Wednesday she'll be able to join us and we'll get to see the work being done by video, which will be very cool.
Great.
May 29 now at 2 o'clock Eastern time is going to be our 500th show. So that's going to be live on YouTube. We'll record it, of course, but live on YouTube at 2 o'clock Eastern on the 29th. So join us for that. Lining up guests, and as we've discussed multiple times, Jennifer is planning an all-day thing. We're starting at 2 o'clock. Jennifer's going to start at sunrise, I think, is what the plan is.
Will there be a podcast that day, too?
No, this is going to be the podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. So cool. Actually, what I'll probably do is record the audio track. Yeah, that's what I'll do that. I'll record the audio track and put that up as a podcast because the vast majority of people listen to shows through apps. So I will do that. Yeah, good point. So there will be a podcast. It will be of that show. Yeah.
Great.
Skin cells is the topic of the moment. We were talking before the show, and you ran into a YouTube video. What's the story again?
Okay, so we've talked before about the other kinds of podcasts that I listen to, and right. One of the nerdiest is This Week in Virology, and so it's about viruses that make us sick.
You're so much fun at a party.
People laugh at me. So one of the things that they do at the end of some of their, they do like three a week, but they have picks of the week by the members of the show. And they might be related to virology, but most of the time they're not. And one of them that came up a couple of weeks ago was Baumgartner's Fine Art Restoration. This is a guy that restores art in the Chicago area. And he's the second generation to do this. His dad started the business, I don't know, I think I read 35 years ago. Anyway, he has a YouTube channel. And he shows how he restores all these paintings. And I had not too long ago seen on one of the Facebook pages, you know, a conversation about, do I put glass on my needlework or do I not put glass on my needlework? And we know that's a conversation that's been going on for a long time and everybody has their opinion. But I'll tell you what, in watching him clean these paintings, you know, a lot of them are way over 100 years old or whatever, but not all of them are. He'll, you know, he turns them over and he takes the stretchers off and then he takes a big soft brush and sweeps all of this dirt and debris and off of the back. And then he turns it over and he starts to clean it. And the first thing he does is to remove surface dirt. And that's a separate task from removing the discolored varnish. And so he was talking about, you know, what's in that surface dirt. And he said, you know, it's smoke, cigarette smoke, maybe fireplace smoke, skin cells, dust. And when I heard him say skin cells, that kind of perked my ears because I used to do air monitoring. It's part of my job in buildings that had mold problems. And those samples are examined under a microscope and the analyst would report, you know, all the different kinds of molds present in the air, but also other debris. And one of the major sources of debris in the air is skin cell fragments because, you know, we're constantly sloughing off skin, dead skin cells from our skin all the time. That's how we, you know, renew our skin.
Yeah, that's a known thing, but every time it comes up, it's just gross.
It's you. Yeah, I know. Anyway, I do put museum glass on my needlework. And hearing that just made me think, yeah, that's really a good reason to put glass on your needlework. It's just to keep all of that stuff floating around in the air, most of which is parts of us.
Ew.
Your needlework.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been on the museum glass side of things. I like to have my pieces covered up.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can brush your needlework off, you know, my mom has this big soft paintbrush that she uses. But you know, that's not going to get stuff that's kind of in between the threads. And some people use a low power vacuum with some net or something over it to protect the stitches. And that would work probably fairly well, but put glass on it. And then you don't have to do that. All you have to do is wipe the glass off.
Right. Right. For a scientist, when he opens one of those paintings, to collect all the dirt front and back, I bet you could spend a year just studying what's in that.
Oh, I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Yeah. You know, something from the 1500s. Oh, man. Yeah. Forever. Yeah.
It's going to be representative of whatever environment it's been in since the last time it was cleaned.
Right.
You know, it's never been cleaned.
Right. Oh, I bet you could just go crazy. Yeah. So how long have you been doing glass? Have you always done glass or have you converted?
I converted. My opinion used to be that this was dimensional work and you couldn't see the dimension if you had glass on it. It would flatten it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long museum glass has been available, but I probably started putting museum glass on maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I have a lot of pieces that don't have glass on them. And I kind of have been trying to put glass on things. I haven't done it for a while, but I'll take down an old piece and take it in and have them take it apart. And sometimes they find spiders in there.
Ew.
Spider webs, you know?
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, that's just it. Especially those little tiny spiders, they'll get anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always done the museum glass, and people say, oh, it's expensive. And then my response to that is, if I'm going to go to the trouble of finishing, framing a piece, archival framing, and putting museum glass on, yeah, it's expensive initially, but 30 years down the road, if you space out that cost over that amount of time, it's really fairly trivial, and then your piece is protected much more. I think.
Absolutely. Anyway. Absolutely. And I have some things on a wall in my bedroom. The bedroom has a south facing window, and the needlework is on the opposite wall. It does not get direct sunlight, but the room is bright. And I can't tell about the threads, but on one piece, at least the mats have faded.
Yeah.
Drastically. And that's one I haven't gotten around to. I will have to replace the mats because they don't match anymore. The threads are still bright, but the mats have just turned gray and grayish. And so they need to be replaced.
Yeah.
And I will put museum glass on it when I do that.
Yeah. The mats, those tend to fade fairly quickly no matter what. Yeah. But at least that's a cheap replacement in relative terms. Yeah.
Right. And that's another thing about the museum glass. It's got UV protection in it.
Right.
So it's going to protect against, sunlight. I mean, you still don't want direct sunlight on a piece, even with the UV protection in the glass. But, it'll protect from UV, from lighting, bright rooms and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I believe firmly that it's worth the cost. For all of those reasons, I think if you're going to pour that much energy, time, and money into a piece and then pay to have it framed, do everything you can to protect it.
Absolutely.
And a good framer, if it's a dimensional piece, a good framer will put spacing in or make them do it, put spacers in to keep the glass off the piece anyway.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you want a spacer in between. I mean, even if you don't put a mat on it, you're going to need a spacer in between the glass and the needlework because you don't want the glass touching the needlework.
Right. Right.
Framers know that.
Yeah. Good ones. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I've always been, for me, because people argue that till they get blue in the face, glass or no glass. To me, there's never been a discussion, protect your stuff. You go to all that trouble, all those hours, protect it. And, and that's just it. People say, well, brush it and vacuum it off. Spare me. Who does that? Who does that? And it's stuff like that, that as it gets dingier, dirt collects on it and so on and so forth. You don't notice it because it is so gradual to you. And so you don't think, I really need to vacuum that off. It looks dirty. It looks the same as it did yesterday. And I've always, cover that stuff up, protect it. Yeah.
Well, and this is something that his name is Julian, has commented about that some people are disappointed when they get their paintings back because they look so bright so they didn't realize how dirty they were.
Yeah.
And, so this kind of pertains to this whole discussion about, do you use the current colors of a reproduction sampler, or do you use the colors that are on the backside that represent what the original colors look like. And his opinion is, for paintings, that the cleaned version of it is what the artist wanted us to see.
Right.
The artist didn't want it to be yellowed. If the artist had wanted it to be yellowed, he would have used yellow. And you know, they didn't know back then, however long ago that was, probably not all that long ago when it comes right down to it, that varnish was going to yellow.
Right, right. And yeah, and they would have never seen it. Yeah.
No, no. I remember a few years ago, they cleaned the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Did you see any of that?
No, no.
There was a lot of conversation about that, that, you know, the colors are too bright. That's not real, you know. Everybody was used to it being dirty.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what they thought it was, the way it thought it was supposed to be. But it's not. That's not the way it was painted.
Well, see, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's something I think I've asked every person we've interviewed who does reproduction samplers, is where do you get your colors, the back or the front? And that's an ongoing problem that I problem isn't the word, but it's an ongoing thing in my mind when it comes to reproduction samplers, is just that, because people will select ground cloth that looks old, you know, intentionally looks old, select muted colors because they want it to look old. And to me, I don't agree with that. I want to see it as close to the original colors as we can get it. And and I've often wondered how many pieces of linen were white or almost white when they started out.
Exactly.
You know, and so therefore the colors would be even, you know, visually brighter and richer. But yeah, let's go back to what the little girl stitched, because the same kind of thing. Cause yeah, you know darn well that Rembrandt and all those masters, they were using bright, rich colors, you know, cause they had them. Why not?
Right.
A yellow daisy is yellow. It's not dingy. It's just,
and the whites,
right.
You know, so many things, on the paintings that I've watched him clean have looked yellowish, and they turn out to be white, bright white. Skies that look green are blue. And it's just really amazing to watch him work through these paintings and clean them up and get them. And of course, everything that he's using is archival and reversible.
Right.
Everything's water-based. You know, he takes great care not to damage the painting by overcleaning it. And a lot of times he has to fix overcleaning, because in the past, some people have actually cleaned a canvas so much that you can see the canvas showing through.
Oh.
The other thing I find interesting is that he uses Belgian linen.
Oh.
So a lot of times the tacking edges are gone. And so he will cut strips of Belgian linen, and it's not the kind of linen that we would stitch on. It's a heavier linen.
Yeah.
You know, he frays the edges and adheres it with a heat bond adhesive that again is entirely reversible. And he frays the edge that is in the canvas, because he doesn't want a sharp edge to telegraph to the front of the canvas. Turn it over. So, you know, he'll fray a quarter inch or so, and that is in the area of the canvas that's going to show after it's restretched.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear some of the things that he's learned from other things that he's done in the past. He uses wool felt, and he commented the other day in one of the videos that I watched that it's not wool felt. He uses wool felt rather than acrylic or something like that. And I don't remember the exact reason that he used the wool felt, but he uses it to absorb moisture and stuff like that. Mm. But he commented that you couldn't get this wool felt, as you know, in a craft store. But it is used by printmakers, and he used to be a printmaker.
Oh.
And so he's, you know, taking things that he learns from other jobs that he's done or people that he's known. But back to the reproduction samplers, I think, you know, the thing about maybe we should qualify reproduction and say we're reproducing the way that it looks now.
Yeah.
And people like that look. They like the faded, or they wouldn't be doing them, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Or the first thing they do is change all the colors if they did. Yeah, no, I know people like them to look old. I just soon but not, it, but
certainly reproducing what the child did, then you'd want to know what the colors are. And I've seen some designers do both colorways, but not very many do.
No.
Does that mean somebody has to stitch it twice?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, and that's, I think that's one of the reasons, one of several reasons I don't like the modeled ground cloth. I want it to be a solid color, whatever the color is. I don't care for that. And I think because I view that as an attempt to make it look like it's faded, not faded, whatever. And I don't care for that. I want a solid colored ground cloth. I tend to like them as light as possible. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm always curious, you know, where'd you get the colors at? And if it's from the back, then I'm more excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause yeah, I mean, we know that the thread colors they had, cloth colors, paint colors were just as vibrant as we have today. You know, they wouldn't mute those. No way. It's not a chance. Especially little girls. They're going full bright. Yeah.
Yeah. And sparkles if they could get them.
You're darn right. Yeah. 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 So, well, that's most interesting. I got to watch this Baumgartner. There's a series of books, mystery detective books, and Gabriel Alon is.
I love those books.
Oh, you know those books.
Daniel Silva.
There we go. That's the author, Daniel Silva. And because his thing is art restoration, but then he gets pulled away to do these spy mystery, solve the case type thing. But what little I picked up from there has just always fascinated me about restoring old paintings.
Yes.
And
that's one of the reasons I like those books.
Yeah. And it's got to be tedious work, just incredibly tedious work.
Oh yeah, and he Julian talks about that. I mean, he spends a lot of time scraping old adhesive backings off, he said that that's what his dad used to give him, you know, to do when he started
the grunt work.
That's what he started with scraping. Ugh. And you know, sometimes he'll use a sharp scalpel and sometimes he uses a dull scalpel. It just depends on what he's scraping off.
Right.
If you like art related mystery type books, you might like Estelle Ryan's Genevieve Lenard books. Each one of them is about a particular artwork by a specific artist. Like the first one is called, where's the first one? The Gauguin Connection.
Okay.
And then there's, you know, the Dante Connection. They're all something connection.
Oh, okay. And all right.
The connection is an artist. And so there's art forgeries and thieves and murderers the main character Genevieve Lenard is autistic. I can't remember what the words they use. It's non-normal. I don't remember. Anyway, they're interesting. And again, they've got this art connection that I enjoy.
Estelle Ryan is the author.
Yes. And okay. I think they're only available digitally.
Okay.
I don't know that they come paperback.
Yeah.
I have on my Nook. I'm pretty sure you could get them through Kindle also.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of them in the series. So.
Okay. On the list, written down. Yeah.
Okay. And then one more thing, I found a website called Art in Fiction, and actually there's a podcast associated with it. And this woman looks for that connection of art of some sort in fiction. And I found it because I was looking for needlework in fiction. And has a list of, I don't know, 5 or 6 needlework books that she's read that have a needlework connection in them of some sort. She does paintings and dance and all different kinds of art.
Hmm. All right. I'll look that up too. Yeah. It's interesting stuff. Cause now, you know, if you want to go further down that path, one of my favorite authors is Michael Connelly and his Harry Bosch series.
Yes.
And the jazz, because Harry Bosch is a L.A. detective, but also a jazz freak, classic old jazz.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I keep, every time I read the book, I mean to write down the artist that he mentions that Harry is listening to while he's doing research or whatever. And I don't. And I assume there's a website that lists every artist that Harry Bosch listens to. You know, there's got to be that.
I wouldn't be surprised. Connelly's website might have that.
Oh, it could be. I'll look there. But I mean, if people are looking for detective books, the Harry Bosch series is superb, and the it's on Prime. It's just called Bosch. There's 3 seasons. I think it's 3. Extremely well done. And then they just released on Freevee, which used to be IMDb or whatever. It's now called Freevee, Bosch Legacy, which is a continuation of that. And it's extremely well done too. But it's interesting, some of these authors, how they'll bring an art aspect in. And I gotta check that out. Because see, here's, and I'm so glad you mentioned those. And I haven't listened to or read a Daniel Silva, Gabriel Alon book in a long time. I got to go back and see where I ended up. But bike riding now these days, I run out of podcasts that interest me. And I have these headphones. They're called bone conduction. I can't talk, but they're called bone conduction headphones. And they're superb. And you think, and they lay on your skull in front of your ear. They don't go in your ear.
Right.
And the sound is conducted through the bones and blah, 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 blah. And I don't, but anyway, it used to be that technique or that technology was just really crappy. But now anymore, it is superb. And the best thing is that you can hear what you're listening to, but you also can hear what's going on around you. Because I am really opposed to putting headphones or earbuds of any kind in your ears, especially if you're out riding on the road.
Absolutely.
Too dangerous. But these things, I can hear all the cars coming. I can hear everything and still enjoy the podcast or whatever. But I'm running out. I'm all caught up on my favorites. And you've given me a list before. I need to dip into that. But I've been thinking about just starting to listen to books that way, because, you know, I'll be out on my bike 2, 3, 4 hours, and I can get through a lot of book in that time. So,
oh yeah,
yeah. But that's those bone conduction headphones are, I love them. I actually mine I forget that I have them on.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't even notice because you can hear everything around you. And I've been known to go, the last time I got a haircut, I sat down and the person cutting my hair said, can these come off? And I said, what? your whatever these are. And I'd forgotten. I just, they just are on all day long. I don't think about it.
They have to stay there.
yeah, exactly. exactly. Otherwise I keel over. Yep. But yeah, they're excellent for that. And talk on the phone. I use them to talk on the phone, everything. They're really good.
I had intended to get a set myself because I've heard you talk about them before. And then I got hearing aids that have Bluetooth capability. I don't ride. I use them at the gym when I'm walking around the track. So I don't ride a bicycle. I don't know how well you can hear other stuff when an audiobook is playing.
Yeah.
Or podcast or whatever. I haven't tried that. So I don't know. But I can use them to talk on the phone and I love it. It's great.
Now, you can connect those to TV or whatever?
I don't know. Probably. And it should be anything that you can do Bluetooth.
Yeah.
Although I could not get it to work with my computer.
Okay. Because see, for me, that would be almost a requirement, is it? Because if you can connect to your phone, yeah, you should be able to connect to a TV. Mm-hmm. To me, that's, hearing aids. Oh, my hearing's deteriorated. I got to get hearing aids. No, that's a plus. We used to joke. My Margaret's dad wore hearing aids, and those were the old fashioned kind. And Margaret's mother, she would just go on and on and on, and just stop it, And Walter was his name, and called him Wally. He'd be sitting there, and she'd just be going on and on, just haranguing about this, that, and the other thing. And you'd see him, we would just laugh. You'd see him just kind of put his hand up to the side of his face, like he was going to lean rest on his hand. And you'd see that index finger go up and grab that volume wheel. And you could see, see him just slowly move it down. And then there would this look of peace would go over his face, and he would just sit there.
I used to do hearing conservation training every year when I worked in industry, and all the guys in the class laughed whenever I said, that there's a reason that your wives nag at you about not listening to them. And that's if you have noise induced hearing loss, that's because you lose the high frequencies first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His voice are higher than men's voices.
Right.
So, that justified their, not listening to their wives. But of course we wanted to prevent the noise induced hearing loss, not make it desirable.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite lines, I think it was a show called The Middle, Patricia Heaton, who's not my favorite character. She always just strikes me as just nothing but a shrew, no matter what role she plays. But it was about a family in Indiana that, living hand to mouth kind of thing, and the experiences they had. And
I think I remember it vaguely.
Yeah, we watched it all the way through, but you had to have something else to do while it was on. I mean, it was about one level deep. But Mike, I think, was the husband. And she was talking about something and then referred to having discussed this in the past. And his line was, oh, that's back when I thought I had to listen to everything you said. Yeah. Since then, I've learned to tune you out, lady.
We all do, don't we?
I think we do. I think we do. Yep. All right, so... skin cells And you. Books, so Estelle Ryan, Gabriel Ilan, Art and Fiction. All right, we're learning things today. This is great. So Baumgartner Restoration. If you missed that, Baumgartner Restoration video. Is a podcast too or just videos?
Just videos. It's a YouTube channel.
Okay. I got to check him out. That looks like it'd be fun to watch. Yep. Yeah.
It's kind of addictive.
Yeah, exactly.
But they do get repetitive, you know, because he's doing the same thing.
Right.
On pretty much every painting. But it really is interesting to see how he approaches the challenges that different artworks present to him.
Yeah. See, I love that stuff. The artisans, master artisans who do that work. I'll watch that stuff all day long because to me, that's where the rubber hits the road. Yeah. Oh, here's a restored painting. Yeah. Great. I want to know how he did it. Where did he have trouble? What did he have to do? Like you talked about before we recorded where he had to deal with one that was ripped. I want to, how'd you fix that? You know?
Yeah. And he put one that was painted on wood that was broken into like 5 sections.
Ooh.
He put that back together.
Oh. See? Oh, I got to see that. I got to see that.
Okay. So here's another one for you. I can't remember if this is on Prime or Netflix, but it's called The Repair Shop.
I've seen it. It's superb. Yeah.
And the woman that repairs needlework is a Royal School graduate or tutor. I don't know if she's still a tutor, but it's so much fun to watch people bring something back to not original. You know, you're never going to get it back to original, but back to something that looks really, really nice and. Yep. You know, can be enjoyed again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a great series, The Repair Shop. Oh, man. And of course, you know that when people bring stuff in, they're paying a pretty penny to have that work done. But
Oh, no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But oh, yeah. The expertise they bring to those things and oh, you just learn so much. It's so cool. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, the repair shop. Yep, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a place you just want to hang out in all day.
Yes.
You know, I'll get my breakfast. I'll be over. I ain't leaving all day long. I'm just going to go from area to area and just watch you guys work. Yep.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep.
Okay, we got stuff to do now. All right, so an interesting thing happened this week.
Yeah.
And the Wool and the Floss in near Detroit, suburb of mm-hmm. Detroit. She announced that she is closing basically half of her business. She is closing the yarn knitting half, knitting crochet, the yarn half of her business.
And,
wow. And keeping alive the painted, she's a painted canvas shop.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping that going. We've done 2 shows with her.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think I'd have written her name down, but I didn't. But and I can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The Wool and the Floss. But the reason she's doing it is that she says in her announcement, most of the popular yarn lines now sell direct, and many of the others are available at discount yarn sites. So basically, to keep a retail shop going with yarns, she can't compete.
Yeah.
So you just shut that down, but then she's keeping the needlepoint part. And it was just one more, for me, one more example, one more step in what I firmly believe, and accelerated by the pandemic, is an evolution in local needlework shops. That it, mm-hmm. that it is going to occur, is occurring, and is going to occur. And I would venture that 5 years from now, we're going to have different local needlework shops than we have today or had 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to evolve or they're going to close.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because, I mean, it, the fact that she's shutting down the yarn part, you know, neither here nor there, that's a business decision. But the reasoning is I'm not carrying this stuff because you can get it elsewhere and people are getting it elsewhere. So I'm using up a lot of retail space for yarns that aren't moving because people are getting them elsewhere without having to come to the store or getting them cheaper and or both. I bring this up for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's an interesting evolution, but then you say, all right, well then why is that, or can that happen to local needlework stores? And so I was thinking about that. I'm not sure it's the same thing because I don't think yarns come in as many subtle colors as, say, DMC floss.
Right.
So,
and you also take a lot more room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that too. Yeah. Yeah.
So is a store, a big box store, going to carry the full color line? Probably not.
No, because just sheer bulk. Yeah, sheer retail space. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I've heard from similar shops that do needlework and yarn and knitting or crochet and crocheting is that, you know, people will buy their yarn at a big box store cheaper than they could buy it in the specialty store, and then come in and want help. And in helping them, the owner or whoever's helping them, you know, realizes that the yarn might be the same label, but it's not the same quality as she's in her store. And then there's the whole, you know, I bought this someplace else, but I need help. Can you help me? and you know, here again, we've heard or read on Facebook, you know, that there are shop owners that don't want any part of that. Then there's other shop owners that are happy to, because they know that most of the time person's going to spend more money in their shop.
Yeah. Yeah. See, for me, in that instance right there, there would be a board on the wall that would say, these are my fees for help. Basically, if you buy your stuff elsewhere, these are my fees for helping you. I'm happy to help you. And yes, you'll spend more money here. More than happy to help you, give you my expertise, but you know, these are my fees. It's X amount per half hour for me to sit down with your substandard yarn or your substandard floss and your cheap linen and help you stitch. And you're going to pay for this sooner or later. You want my expertise? This is it. You buy the stuff here, I'm free all day long. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Because see, it for me, it's the kind of thing, and I've not talked to any bike shop owners, but I know the same thing is happening. It's happening in all the hobbies, but the same thing happens in bike shops. There are online places all over the world where you can buy bikes, most of them high end, very expensive bikes, but where you can mail order. How old am I? But you know, you can order a bike and have it sent to your house, okay?
Yeah.
And if you're adept, you can easily put it together and be out riding in a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. But many of them will say, if you're having trouble, take it to your local bike shop. I think that, you know, my initial reaction is that's incredible gall to walk into a bike shop with a partially assembled bike that you bought elsewhere. Will you help me put this together? Yes, I will. Here are our fees for doing that work. I'm happy to help you.
And I'll put you on the schedule.
Right.
It'll be 5 weeks.
Exactly. That's an excellent point, because bike shops these days are, for repair work, a week to 2 weeks out. I've been waiting 3 weeks now for my road bike for new shifting cables because they can't get the parts. And so they're a week to two, and that's exactly right. Yes. And I'll put you on the schedule. However, if you'd bought the bike from us the day you bought it, you would have walked out of here with it fully assembled, adjusted, and fitted for you at no extra cost, you know? So they're all dealing with this. And it's, to me, it's how do you adapt to that? It's not, you know, you can't slam the door. You can't put up a brick wall and say, this is, you know, it's my way or the highway. You have to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so how do you adapt to that and still stay in business and still be profitable?
Right.
And that's not an easy road. And then, so then I start to think when you see this stuff, what's happening to local needlework stores? Like last time we talked to Kim Young, as she's building her new shop, she's going to have computers where you can download, purchase and download online PDF charts
mm-hmm.
right there, print them out, and then she'll kit them for you. Okay, mm-hmm. that's adapting to the reality that so many charts are available for online download.
Right.
So then, all right, so the, all right, what, all right, that, so that, you start to look at that, but then what do shops become? What does a shop look like? What can they offer that no one else can offer? And that starts to be classes and events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they start to ramp that kind of thing up?
Yeah.
I'm not sure where it's going to go, but it's going to go somewhere. I guarantee you that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that, yeah, you know, a lot of people can learn to do this sort of thing from books, and there's plenty of books out there that have great photographs and all of that. But actually, an awful lot of people will buy a cross-stitch chart that may or may not have basic instructions in it and just start stitching. And that is fantastic. And I think it's great that they're doing it. But sooner or later, you know, that they are probably going to want to get better. And yeah. At that point, they go. You know, yeah, there's probably, and younger people are going to go straight to YouTube.
Right.
Because that's what they're accustomed to. But, you know, if they find that there's a shop or a guild in their area that is, you know, helping people learn and they want that community. I guess that's what you don't have online is community.
Right.
You do, through Facebook or Reddit or, you know, whatever. There's people on there that are showing their things. But I can't help but think that an awful lot of them would love to get together at a local coffee shop with, you know, two or three or five other stitchers
right.
and stitch and chat, you know, or go to a guild meeting and stitch and chat.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know how to find those local people.
Right. So then your local needlework shop, make yourself the place.
Yeah.
You know, find some room for tables. Because you make a good point. Now, see, I'm at a disadvantage in that the male-female thing comes in because, my observation as a male is that exactly that, women more so than men almost need to get together to enjoy these things and find great pleasure and great escape from the day-to-day cooking, kids, and whatever in getting together that men don't necessarily need, I guess. I'm going to get in trouble with the words, but whatever.
Didn't you enjoy your get-togethers at the attic with the guys?
Yeah. Yeah, we enjoyed that. But once a year, you know.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like I'd love being alone, so I'm kind of a problematic thing in the first place. But I don't know. Oh, yeah. I don't have a burning need to sit in a room full of people to stitch. I'd prefer to do that alone. It's one of the things taking classes. I don't generally have interest in taking classes. I never get anything done. You know, so give me the instructions. But see, I'm also someone who learns by reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I'm fine by myself learning by reading. And that's, you know, that's another thing that comes into play is the different ways that people learn, and shops need to be aware of that too.
But you've also said that you have a hard time evaluating whether or not you're doing something right or getting better or whatever, and would appreciate somebody's opinion.
Yes.
Now, maybe that's not your you know, whoever's sitting next to you at a class or whatever, but the teacher. Yeah, I mean, who appreciates the opinion of somebody sitting next to them? Yeah. Unless it's, ooh, that's gorgeous, you know?
Right, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, that, you know, and that's the thing is, you know, I will forever treasure the time that Natalie Dupuy spent with us at the EGA seminar when she went over my pieces. That was one of the most educational 45 minutes I think I've ever had. You know, where she just critiquing pieces that I'd done a long time ago. But it was, that was really valuable. So yes, I have that, but to, for it to be a social thing, no. Yeah. And, like bike riding, I, you know, to me, just, I just leave me alone. I just go and I just don't want to be around. There's a bike club of retired people basically who ride an awful lot around the St. Louis area. And I've thought several times about joining them, and it's like, nah, I'll just go ride by myself. so yes, yeah, yeah. So I don't know, but am I right? Is that a woman thing that more than men?
Oh yeah, probably.
Okay.
And you know, some of it depends on, you know, how you, what you get out of whatever it is you're doing. You bike ride to, you know. That's your form of meditation.
Yes.
From everything I've heard you say.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
You don't meditate with people. It doesn't work.
No.
You know, that's something you do on your own, and your purpose is to get out there and get some exercise and, you know, just kind of relax into the whole enjoyment of just riding a bicycle.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, there's the first half hour of effort and getting loose and so on and so forth. And then your body realizes we're going to do this for a while and it just gets into a rhythm. And then, yeah, then my mind just clears out. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Can't beat it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the same thing happens with needlework. You're really focusing on it and yeah, maybe you got something running in the background, you know, that you listen to a little bit here and there. But really, it is kind of a solitary thing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have more than one person working on what we do. You know, maybe that happens at the Royal School or, you know, somebody's working on a big tapestry for something or other. You might have more than one person working on it at a time, but that's not common.
No.
Normally, we're just sitting wherever we stitch by ourselves or maybe with our spouses or whatever. I do enjoy both. I enjoy getting together with other people who like to stitch. I don't always get all that much done because, you know, light and chair and, you know, I don't have my floor frame and all of that other kind of stuff that you have in your normal stitching area.
Right, right.
But, you know, doesn't mean that whatever I've done is a waste of time unless it's something that I made a mistake that I couldn't see and I have to take it out when I get home.
Yeah, that's annoying.
Yeah, that happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's because I didn't have the right magnification, whatever,
yeah,
you know, reading glasses or whatever while I was out stitching. So that's something that, you know, you can take care of pretty easily.
Right.
And choosing the piece that you're stitching on away from whatever. That's not when I pick a 40 count piece of linen.
Yeah, you got to be selective there. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yep. A 14 count paper, perforated paper is real good.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have trouble seeing those holes.
Yep. Yeah. You can talk all day and do that. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
This was just one more thing. That one more proof of the process here that there is change and there's going to be change, and the shops that adapt and evolve and seize opportunities. You know, that's the other thing is seizing opportunities. You know, how many shops when online ordering became a thing resisted it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's plenty of shops that don't have online ordering.
Yeah.
That I'd order from if they did.
That's just it. But then the shops that embraced it, that's a I'm sure a big chunk, maybe the biggest chunk of their business.
Might be. Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's over the last 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you didn't have that, you're dead in the water. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just going to be interesting to see and to see who it is that steps back from the day-to-day activities and evaluates what's going on and looks for ways to seize the opportunities to grow their business in different ways. And 'cause the standard way of I open my doors at 11 o'clock in the morning and close them at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, hope you'll come in, that is going to fade into the woodwork. It's not going to be enough. It's just not.
You're right. So I wonder how, some of there's a lot of people who make specialty yarns that are not going to sell them in a big box store because they don't make enough.
Yeah.
So I wonder what will happen to them. I wonder if they'll just go, they probably will go online, but then you face the same issue that we face is what is that color really?
Right. Right.
And what does it really feel like?
Yep. Yeah. And yarn, that's important. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how much thread I've bought trying to get the right color. Mm-hmm. I must have 10 different colors of silk lamé in pinky purples to get the one that was the right color.
Yeah. 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 That's a problem. Yeah.
Now I'll use them sooner or later.
Yeah.
And something else. But yeah, when you don't have a shop that you can go to, or when the shop doesn't carry the full line,
right?
Then that's what you do.
Yep.
You add to your stash.
That's right. That's right. And you'll use it sooner or later, like you said. You'll use it. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, it's going to be interesting to see it happen, and it's interesting to watch it happen now. And Wool in the Floss is, one more step in that whatever that direction is. I don't even know what it is.
Well, and it could be that, she's got enough business with the painted canvas that she can expand that and still be able to, because she's going to have a lot more space.
Right.
With yarn gone.
Well, and that's the other thing that we haven't seen yet and she hasn't offered. Maybe that gives her exactly the opportunity to evolve, have more classes, have more events. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out because, maybe that's the unspoken part of this. Yeah, I'm getting rid of all the yarn for this reason, but look what it's going to allow me to do on the other side. Yeah.
So I've taken a couple of canvas embellishment classes, one of them with Jill Rigoli of Banji Designs.
Mm-hmm.
Are fun.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people were in the class. We maybe had 10 or 12. She took each person with their canvas into, because we were in a classroom, so we were away from the shop.
Right.
She took everybody down to the store on the first level and helped them choose the threads and the embellishments, the sequins or the beads or whatever. And then we'd go back upstairs and she'd, suggest some stitches to use and you'd start stitching away. That was a lot of fun.
And you can't do that without a store. Yeah.
You can't do that without a store, but as you say, that gives the Wool in the Floss the opportunity maybe to do more of that.
Right.
To bring in these features that help people, a lot of people don't want to choose their own stitches and threads and all of that. They want somebody to help them and that's great.
Yep.
And this, that's a way for the shop to expand their visibility.
Right.
I mean, look at the attic. You know, when I look at their newsletters and I see the classes that they're offering, how many of them are stamped already full?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They sell out immediately. Yep. Same thing. Yep. Yep.
And And a lot of that is probably because the people that are in the class sign up for next year's class or next 6 months class or whatever before they ever leave.
Yeah. Yep.
First class they're in.
Yep.
And you know, so that kind of thing that you get, and I'm sure that all of those people are not from the Phoenix area.
No, heavens no, no.
You know, they're coming from all over the country, maybe from all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Yep.
So that's what, in my opinion, I think that's what needle workshops need to do is to, you know, get people, teachers into the stores to teach whatever people are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you can get people in for a class, they're going to buy other things.
Yep. Oh yeah. You'll get your money. Yep. You'll get it. Yep.
Yeah. Not yep. just on the class and the supplies for that, but you know, people walk around and see a new chart that they didn't know about yep. or, you know, a new thread or a piece of fabric or a new needle minder or, you know, whatever it
is. Yep. Yeah. It'll pay off. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Need to wrap it up. Join us tonight for Stitching and Chatting. Nancy Lukoski on Sunday. And thanks for listening.
Bye.